The battlefield consequences of the release of these documents are potentially severe and dangerous.
That was Defense Secretary Gates denouncing WikiLeaks a few weeks ago. But as the democracy movement spreads in the Arab world, information supplied by WikiLeaks earlier this year continues to provide context. Today's New York Times has a front-page article about State Department cables released by WikiLeaks that detail how the Obama administration changed its approach to Egypt from the Bush administration. Mostly, the Obama folks decided not to publicly denounce Egypt's human rights record as much, but rather apply pressure behind the scenes. A cable from the U.S. Embassy in 2009 was pessimistic about the impact of the Facebook-based pro-democracy group, a group now credited with helping launch the current protests. Egyptian President Mubarak was cited in the cables as believing Iran is trying to establish pockets of influence in Egypt through the Muslim Brotherhood movement there. And in Yemen, where the protests have now spread, one of the most highly reported on WikiLeaks revelations was the cable that acknowledged that the U.S. had carried out anti-Al-Qaeda drone strikes inside the country, even though Yemen's president, Saleh, took public responsibility for them. We will take a closer look at the situation in Yemen, the complex nexus of pro-democracy, pro-Al-Qaeda, and other forces in a few minutes. But the New York Times Magazine this weekend will feature an in-depth account of the Times' relationship with WikiLeaks as the paper published a series of articles recently based on some of the 250,000 U.S. State Department cables that WikiLeaks obtained and documents pertaining to the Iraq and Afghanistan wars before that. I've read the article, which is by the Times executive editor Bill Keller, and among the most interesting parts to me, the Times regarded Julian Assange as a source, not a partner, but thinks WikiLeaks should be shielded from prosecution, like any news organization, for publishing the leaks. The State Department cables were available to about 500,000 government employees and were not classified as top secret. The Times regarded the Obama administration reaction to the WikiLeaks release as professional and sober, unlike the Bush administration reaction to the Times story about warrantless wiretaps. The warnings that publishing the cables would make foreign leaders stop talking to Washington do not seem to have come true, says the Times, and revelations about Tunisia in the WikiLeaks articles helped fuel the uprising there, according to Bill Keller, the executive editor. Again, that article will be in the Times Magazine this weekend, and with me to discuss it and the Obama administration's relationship to the Arab pro-democracy movement, as well as some of the latest details there, like Al-Baradei being put under house arrest, reportedly, is the Times London bureau chief, John Burns. Hi, John. So great of you to do this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Yes, good morning.
Let me go through some of those points and a few others. First, do you agree that the WikiLeaks State Department cables are playing a role in Tunisia or anywhere else in the Arab pro-democracy movement?
Yeah, that seems beyond question, and my guess is that it will shift the paradigm on the question of prosecution of WikiLeaks or condemnation of WikiLeaks. Of course, we cannot know what the Obama administration will do. It's certainly taken a lot of time in its deliberations over this. But if the net effect of those State Department cables, the release of them, has been to, if you will, move the Middle East closer to more open government, let us hope more democratic government, then it seems to me it will further complicate the calculation of those who would like to see criminal prosecution of WikiLeaks.
That's fascinating. One guest who we had previously said Tunisians certainly knew of Ben Ali's dictatorship and brutality. They were living under it. But the State Department cables showed them that America had contempt for him, too. And that helped give the elite in Tunisia permission to push the revolt. Does that ring true to you?
Well, you know, I've covered parts of the Middle East somewhat removed from Tunisia. I've personally never been there, but certainly from everything I have read and seen of this, it seems unquestionable that there has been that effect. It tells us a lot of things. Amongst other things, it tells us the reach of the United States, the fact that the release of those cables told people in Tunisia that the United States would have, in effect, a lot of sympathy for any kind of movement against an autocratic government in Tunisia. It tells us something about the way that the world still sees the United States, at least the respect for which American power is held, and I would also say respect for, you know, the persistent American support for open and democratic government around the world.
As the magazine article mentions, you wrote a front-page profile of Julian Assange in October that documented fractures within WikiLeaks over his imperious leadership style and that he denounced as a smear. Can you remind us of those fractures? People probably think of WikiLeaks as being only Assange sitting somewhere with an internet connection.
No, the organization has been seriously fractured in recent months, to the extent that Assange has been saying privately, so I'm told, in the last 2 or 3 weeks, that the organization itself has been seriously impeded in doing its work. Of course, that is partly as a result of the U.S. government pressure that was brought to bear on some of the organizations like PayPal, MasterCard, other organizations that were assisting, in effect, in the collection of donations to WikiLeaks. But it's also been affected by the defection of some fairly important associates of Julian Assange's who were involved in setting up this complex network of servers around the world, encrypting the information, the secret documents. And that has been impeded. He only had 40 core people in this organization, several hundred more people who volunteered their service, but essentially about 40, this is his figure, 40 insiders. And some of the most important of those have, in fact, broken with him. And in one case, the former spokesman, I'm inclined to say number two man in the whole organization, a German by the name of Daniel Domscheit-Berg, who used the pseudonym Schmidt, has actually gone to the extent of founding a new and rival organization to be called OpenLeaks.
Wow. The magazine article calls your October article the last straw in the Times relationship with Assange. The last straw in what sense?
Well, I think there were a number of points of tension, but this was certainly the most important of them. And this came in the wake of the release of the Iraq and Afghan war documents and before the release of the State Department cables. And Assange broke with us and said he would no longer supply us with those cables. As it turned out, it was a moot point anyway because we obtained the cables independently and partly, I dare say, as a result of this fracturing of WikiLeaks. Somebody who had been associated with WikiLeaks who had those documents agreed to let us have them. I believe a woman named Heather Brooks, who is of joint British and American citizenship from Seattle, who is a Freedom of Information campaigner, very skilled in that work. In any case, we obtained the documents from her. And what happened was that in the aftermath of that, although that infuriated Assange, who not for the first time, in effect, complained loudly about his documents being leaked, which you might think is a little bit ironic. We worked out an arrangement with The Guardian in England, The Guardian newspaper, and with other organizations, which Assange calls his media partners, Der Spiegel in Germany and magazine El País in Spain, to have a coordinated release of those documents. And that's where the matter now stands. But there's no question that Mr. Assange dislikes me intensely. I don't think he likes Mr. Keller very much anymore, our executive editor. So it's not exactly an embrace.
The Times London Bureau Chief John Burns with us. And the Times, according to the magazine article, considers WikiLeaks a source and not a collaborator in publishing these State Department documents that WikiLeaks obtained. Why is that an important distinction?
Well, I think it's always an important distinction. As Bill Keller has said in the article that you refer to, which is actually the first, it's the introduction to an e-book, which the Times is publishing even as we speak. on the whole WikiLeaks saga. And as Bill Keller says, we don't get to choose our sources. And if we were to, if you will, shun sources on the basis of character assessment, that would be a major shift. It does make us wary. It probably intensifies our determination to verify the authenticity of documents. But the fact that Assange is a complex, somewhat contradictory, imperious character, as I have experienced him, would not of course alone be a reason for shunning the documents which he has obtained. Now there are those, and they are numerous, as I judge it from the number of blogs and emails that both Bill Keller's article and articles I've written have attracted. The loudest voices in those blogs condemn us, in effect, for paying any attention to the personality of Assange, saying that all that matters is the documents. Now, that's not a road down which we could possibly go. Obviously, we owe to the reader, and Bill Keller's article, I have to say, is a fully candid and engaging account of this whole saga of our engagement with WikiLeaks. We could hardly have disguised from the readership of the New York Times what we had come to know about Assange and WikiLeaks. That would have been meretricious. So we've tried to balance the two, but I don't think we're going to get into the business of shunning material because we don't like the source. Although, as I've said, it will, when we find there are things about the source which give us reason for some concern, it will certainly heighten the intensity of our authentication of whatever documents or information comes to us from those sources.
Reasons for concern, such as the article describing Assange as elusive, manipulative, and volatile. Would you say that it's accurate to conclude that Assange ultimately agreed to the New York Times standards of what to redact in the State Department documents to protect individuals' lives?
I think it was a moment of great crisis for Assange after the release of the initial documents on Afghanistan, when they had rushed the fences and had broken Assange's own undertaking to redact those documents to remove the names of informants and others whose lives might be at risk. He in effect broke with that undertaking, blamed the Pentagon, oddly, saying that they had refused to help him redact the documents. Well, in any case, there was such an outcry about that, including from within WikiLeaks itself. This was one of the points which caused the fracturing of the WikiLeaks leadership, and he then became very much more careful about the redaction in the second round of releases relating to the Iraq war. And it's significant, I think, that of the several hundred thousand documents, pushing on now, I think, towards 1 million documents, secret American military and diplomatic documents, only a minority of them have ever actually been posted by WikiLeaks. And one of the reasons for that is that he lacks the resources, as he himself has said, to redact them in a hurry, but it's certainly a lesson learned as far as WikiLeaks is concerned.
Although the magazine article says at one point Assange threatened to release all 250,000 documents if he was arrested or charged with anything related to the leaks. That sounds like journalism by blackmail, not the highest journalistic standards. But are you suggesting that he lacks the ability to follow through on that threat?
No, I think he has the ability. He holds the key. He has the key to the encryption, and it's a threat that he's made a number of times. It's a threat which, at least if you ask my opinion, is contradictory to many of the values that he has espoused. If you talk about open information, a world where it's, to my mind, millennial and messianic to think that you could create such a world. In fact, it would be rather frightening, a world of information without borders where there are no secrets, no state secrets certainly, and not much privacy either, then it seems somewhat contradictory to then start saying, well, actually there's another consideration in all of this, and that's whether it suits my interest or not. In other words, Assange himself places himself, in effect, in the position of being the decider as to what the world should know and what they shouldn't know, which I would have thought was a direct contradiction of the initial principles on which he founded WikiLeaks.
Today's New York Times and my guest John Burns, the Times London correspondent, as we talk about what's going on in the Arab pro-democracy movement and also preview an article in the Sunday Times magazine by the Times executive editor Bill Keller, also the introduction to a Times e-book that article is on the Times relationships with WikiLeaks. Today's Times, John, calls WikiLeaks an anti-secrecy organization. And that's different from characterizing it as a group out to weaken the United States, which we often hear. Which one would you say is more accurate?
Well, I think it's both, and I think you've just put your finger on an inherent contradiction in WikiLeaks and indeed in Assange himself. If we scroll back to 2006 when he founded the organization, the notion then, and there's plenty of material supporting this, was that it would be a nonpartisan kind of black box into which whistleblowers of all types and of all from all nations and of all lines of inquiry could safely deposit information which, with their own identities guarded, and which could then be responsibly disseminated. Assange was the founder of that. He was the inspirer of all of that. But at the same time, he had, even then, and very much more clearly in the past year, he had become increasingly hostile to the United States. And if you listen to him, along with that, if you will, non-partisan, non-discriminatory charter that he laid down, there's a polemic, a very, very angry polemic in much that Assange has to say. He regards the United States, as he says on public platforms, as being the greatest threat to democracy in the world. He regards it as being, he doesn't use the word exactly, but he talks about it in effect as a kind of military dictatorship. You know, it's the Ike military industrial complex speech on steroids, if you will. And those two aims have led to tremendous strains within WikiLeaks. A number of those who have broken with him have said that they're not comfortable with the notion of it, the organization being used, in effect, as a vehicle for attacks on the United States. They think that it should be very careful to... Now, of course, the fact is that obtaining the secrets of China or Russia or other states which are more commonly accepted in the world as being repressive is a lot more difficult than obtaining American secrets, precisely because they are repressive societies, because they do guard their secrets so much more carefully, and because they punish so severely anybody who discloses them.
Coming up in a few minutes, listeners, a banned blogger from Yemen speaks out on our show as the pro-democracy protests take shape there. Few more minutes with John Burns first. And John, back to the Middle East. The Times today reports that one of the State Department cables released by WikiLeaks from Egypt had President Mubarak fearing Iranian pockets of influence in his country through the Muslim Brotherhood movement. That movement has now joined the protests. Do you think, from your reporting, that Iranian influence could ironically spread in the region as a result of the pro-democracy movement, as it has spread in Iraq and Lebanon when more of the public had a voice?
You know, I think I have to enter a disclaimer here. I haven't reported in some years from Egypt or Iran, although I know them both. On the face of it, it sounds a little improbable, doesn't it, that a militant Shiite Islamic government in Iran could have that sort of influence in an overwhelmingly Sunni Egypt. But these are complications which, to be honest with you, are a little bit beyond my reach. So I probably had better recuse myself.
Okay, well, from where
that.
You
but
said
it's the sort
it...
of thing you would expect, wouldn't you, an embattled authoritarian leader to say, especially when he's looking for American support.
Indeed. And I know you have reported from the region and from around the world for many years, so based on your accumulated experience, I wonder if you have a thought on this. We had the Egyptian-born columnist Mona El-Tahawi here yesterday, who compared what's going on in the Arab world now to democracy spreading through Eastern Europe as communism collapsed region-wide in 1989. Do you think that's accurate or exaggerated?
You know, the proof of the pudding, et cetera, et cetera. I think we have to be really concerned, and I'm sure that the people in the Obama administration are very concerned about where this might lead, because the most powerful political organization, even if repressed in Egypt, after the government itself, is the Muslim Brotherhood. And you'd have to believe that there is a serious risk if these administrations in places like Cairo and Sana'a in Yemen collapse, that the most powerful force pushing itself forward as a new governing body would be the Islamic militants, and that, of course, would mean a complete rewriting of the map of the Arab world. So we'll have to see where this goes. I wouldn't have thought that it was safe at this point to assume the outcome of all of this is going to be democracy as we understand it.
And finally, wrapping it back up with WikiLeaks, our next guest will be a Yemeni blogger banned by the government there. What do you see as the impact of the State Department cable that revealed that the U.S. staged drone strikes there, but Yemen's president claimed it was his own government? Any relationship between that and the movement?
Well, you know, my experience in the Arab world is, and elsewhere that I've traveled, is the people are smart. They are not stupid. And the people of Yemen would have been perfectly well aware that no matter what Ali Abdullah Saleh, the president of that country, said, the sorts of strikes that were being conducted, airstrikes, against Islamic militants in the Yemen were beyond the competence of the Yemeni government and its rather meager and aging force of MiG fighter bombers. I think they knew what was going on. I think it may have accelerated some of these protests in the sense of making more explicit just how deceitful Mr. Saleh has been about that and other issues. But I don't think it can have been much of a surprise to the people in the bazaar in Sana'a that Mr. Saleh does not dispose of Predator drones.
All right. Well, the New York Times Magazine this weekend will feature an in-depth account of the Times' relationship with WikiLeaks, which is also the introduction to an e-book on the topic that the Times is releasing. And we thank New York Times London Bureau Chief John Burns for discussing it with us. John, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And up next, we will speak to that banned blogger from Yemen. He will speak out on our show.